what happened to rebuilding Haiti today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Haiti was promised a lot of aid after the earthquake 6 years ago to help rebuild.
The buzzword 6 years ago was build Haiti back better, and that simply didn't happen.
Also, food has finally been delivered to the Syrian town of Madaya. This aid worker says one starving girl had a simple question for him.
Did you bring food? Because we were so hungry and we were waiting for you.
Plus, a young Syrian-American on what it's like to walk down the street with her head covered.
I would get dirty looks just because I'm wearing the headscarf.
Tonight, she'll be a special guest in the audience for the President's State of the Union address. And what it's like when the girl you once played soccer with is crowned the world's best female player of the year.
I mean, I couldn't be more proud right now.
The stories today on The World. We've got a lot going on here. Later, it's President Obama's last State of the Union address. And on the show today, we'll have the perspective of a young Syrian American on the war in her country and Islamophobia here. But first, let's go to Turkey, where there was a deadly bombing in the heart of Istanbul. It happened in Sultanahmet Square, which is a popular draw for tourists, and tourists seemed to be the target. At least 10 people were killed, most of them German visitors. Turkey's prime minister quickly blamed the attack on ISIS. Earlier today, I spoke with my BBC colleague Paul Wood in Istanbul after he made his way to the site of the blast.
People speak of a fireball followed by windows rattling, and then they rushed out into the street to see bodies or body parts strewn all around. Whoever carried out this attack intended to hit foreigners, intended to hit tourists. The Turkish authorities are working on the assumption that this was an attack by the so-called Islamic State, by ISIS. It's not known for certain the identity of the man, but the assumption is this was an attack by ISIS and a reflection of Turkish foreign policy in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, there was a major terrorist attack blamed on ISIS last October, more than 100 people killed. What does this all say about ISIS's network within Turkey?
I spoke to a foreign intelligence official, an Iraqi, a very senior Iraqi who deals with ISIS every day, and he said he had flown to Ankara to warn the authorities that in the view of Iraqi intelligence, there were some 2,000 ISIS sleeper agents in Turkey and another 5,000 Islamists of different stripes. That wouldn't be entirely surprising. Remember that at the beginning of the Syrian civil war, when Islamists were just starting to arrive, Islamists were tolerated. They had safe houses. They moved back and forward across the border. They were allowed to operate using Turkey as a rear safe area. Over the past year or so, that has changed. And now I'm told, for instance, that the Turkish authorities orchestrated a meeting of anti-ISIS armed groups very recently on the border. ISIS are about to lose a town called Menbej, and I think they are now trying to bring the war back to Turkish soil to punish the Turks for their policy of supporting armed groups fighting ISIS inside Syria.
I mean, in the past, Turkey has been accused of turning a blind eye to the growth of ISIS on their own territory. Has that policy changed a lot, and does Turkey even have the personnel to deal with 2,000 sleeper agents?
I think the Turkish authorities realize they're in a fight now, and they've got a very serious problem. It's not just a matter of the foreign ISIS fighters who come here on their way to Syria and may now be coming back to carry out attacks, if indeed this was an ISIS attack. There are, in the poorer areas of Istanbul, areas where ISIS recruits. This is well known. You can go to Syria and to Iraq. Certainly in the early days, I came across many Turkish jihadis. Some of those are in ISIS. Turkey, at the beginning of this fight, I think it was quite convenient for them to have Islamists fighting in Syria against both the Kurds and President Assad. These are foreign policy objectives that the Turkish government pursued. It's a very different story when there are bomb attacks on Turkish soil. And I think you're going to see a big move, perhaps away from intelligence resources and military resources going to the battle against the Kurds and into the battle against the Islamists. Don't forget in all of this, though, that while ISIS is losing territory, as they are in Syria and Iraq, they have warned not just Turkey, but Europe and the United States too, that they will carry out attacks on their soil.
Will this represent a backlash against Syrians, those who've been there for a while, those who've been there for only a few months?
That's certainly the feel of Syrians living here. Turkey's been incredibly generous and accepting an enormous number of Syrians, some 1.8 million. It's been very generous in its camps. They call them the five-star camps, the refugees, where there's enough food, there are comfortable air-conditioned tents or containers with television. Turkey has absorbed an enormous number of refugees, but you speak to Syrians on the streets of Istanbul, and they're very, very worried about what happens next.
My BBC colleague Paul Wood there speaking with me not far from the site of the bombing today in Istanbul. Meantime, in Syria, help has arrived in the town of Madaya near the Lebanese border. That's where residents were literally starving after being under siege from government and rebel forces for months. A convoy led by the UN and the International Committee of the Red Cross brought in food and medical supplies last night.
You could tell that there is a gleam of hope the moment the first trucks were coming in and the people were cheering. You know, some of them were shaking our hands.
That's Pavel Shishek with the ICRC. He says there was relief in Madaya once people there saw the food. But Shishek says what he saw was a lot of misery.
It was heartbreaking to see because, you know, looking at these people's faces, you could see that they did not have enough food for quite a while. Many people ask us, you know, do you have a piece of bread or a cookie? Because we haven't had that for a long time and we're quite hungry. And then, you know, longer you were talking to the people, you really realized how desperate the situation was. I still remember this little girl who came to me the moment I get out of the car, and then she asked, did you bring food? Because we were so hungry and we were waiting for you. And you listen to her and you look at it in her eyes, and, you know, she was this cute little girl who just pretty much doesn't have anything to do with what is going on in Syria. And you know, this is exactly the tragedy of the conflict that is happening in this country, that, you know, too many people are trapped or caught up by the endless fighting and very little can be sometimes done to help them. It's quite heartbreaking.
Pavel, how do you go about distributing food to people, to so many people who all seem to be starving? I mean, where do you start?
It's quite complicated, but in general, we try to get, you know, a hold of the local communities, local authorities. It's very impressive how the societies inside besieged places organize themselves. So you have a civilian committee that is, you know, responsible for the water infrastructure. Then you have a civilian committee that is responsible for health structures, for the relief aid, such as foods. The biggest challenge actually was to offload 44 trucks in the middle of the night and with a very heavy rain. So that's why it took us so long. We have already seen some food supplies distributed to the people's houses. So that's exactly the job of those local committees. Right now, we are hoping to come back as soon as we can.
Are you hopeful about
that? You know,
with
more aid. Well, I'm very hopeful. I want to be hopeful, especially for those people there. And we are planning to deliver more aid, you know, in the coming days.
The situation in Madaya, I hear, is so bad that UN humanitarian head Stephen O'Brien called for the immediate evacuation of about 400 people. Do you know if trucks or ambulances were able to get safe passage into the town?
So this kind of operations to evacuate people is an extremely complicated process. And of course, our medical teams, we did identify the most serious cases that requires an urgent solution, because otherwise those people's lives would be in danger. Now, this is not happening overnight in Syria, and it requires negotiations between the parties. So for the time being, you know, this solution is trying to be found. And if you can excuse me, I would prefer to stop here in order not to really endanger this kind of discussions.
Pavel Shishek with the International Committee of the Red Cross, thank you for telling us about this trip to Madaya.
Thank you very much.
It's the kind of violence in Syria and in Turkey today that has some Americans worried about Syrian refugees and, by extension, Muslims in general. That tone of fear we've been seeing prompted a tenured professor at a Christian evangelical college in Illinois to push back. She posted comments on Facebook expressing solidarity with Muslims, but now she's in danger of losing her job. Here's the world's Matthew Bell.
Larisha Hawkins has been teaching at Wheaton College west of Chicago for 9 years. She's 43. As a professor of political science, Hawkins tells me that she pushes her students to reach beyond academics and actually live out their beliefs in the real world. For her, as an evangelical Christian, that means standing with the oppressed, marginalized, and most vulnerable. That's why Hawkins put a picture of herself wearing a Muslim headscarf on social media and wore one on campus.
Many of the great lessons, the deepest lessons in life, are forged in the most painful moments, in the Valley of Tears. And that's what this was intended to be, walking with my Muslim sisters in the United States and certainly throughout the world who are oppressed simply on the basis of their religious commitment, their faithful devotion.
On December 10th, Hawkins wrote on Facebook that she stands with Muslims not because they're American, but because they deserve human dignity. They, like me, she wrote, are people of the book. And she went on, we worship the same God. This was all too much for Wheaton College. 5 days later, the office of the provost sent Hawkins a letter. It says her comments about Muslims raise questions about her commitment to the statement of Christian faith that all Wheaton professors have to sign to work there. The administration declined to speak to me for this story, but on the college's website, Wheaton says it takes its statement of faith seriously, and at its core is the belief that, quote, the Lord Jesus Christ died for our sins, and that salvation is through Christ alone. Hawkins is now on academic leave. She is facing possible dismissal while the college examines what it says are the theological implications of her public statements. Hawkins says the idea that she has failed to live up to her statement of faith or somehow denied the divinity of Jesus is flat out wrong.
When the provost says, I'm denying the Trinity, or I'm conflating Islam and Christianity, is that I'm not a Christian. So to call into question the veracity of my faith, my Christian testimony, is egregious, it's offensive to me, and it's on the basis of one clause in a Facebook post.
This sound is taken from a video posted by the Daily Herald. It shows students at Wheaton holding a rally at the campus chapel on Monday in support of Larisha Hawkins. They held signs saying, solidarity does not equal blasphemy. Andrew Shadid is a recent Wheaton graduate and a former student of Hawkins. He helped organize the rally. Shadid says firing Hawkins would be a mistake.
I think Wheaton would be egregiously dismissing an individual who has committed her life to following out the teachings of Jesus.
The idea of Christians and Muslims worshiping the same God is hardly new. As Hawkins mentioned in her Facebook post, Pope Francis has said the same thing. Islamic scholar Omid Safi of Duke University says it's a statement that most Muslims would readily accept as well.
What this professor has said is not at all controversial, either in the world of Christendom at large or within the broader landscape of American religiosity. The only place in which it is controversial is within the world of American evangelical circles.
Muslims consider Jesus to be a messenger of God, someone who performed miracles, and a Messiah who will come again. They do not, of course, see Jesus as God himself. But this whole controversy at Wheaton might be more about politics than theology, says Gary Burge. He's a professor of New Testament at the Evangelical College.
Our fear is that the political extremes that we now see in our country, typified, maybe exacerbated by Donald Trump, have been baptized and brought into the evangelical world. This has probably influenced the public reactivity to Dr. Hawkins' words and her actions.
Hawkins says she wishes she was back in the classroom as the new semester gets underway. For now, she will stay on paid leave as the college's review process plays out. It's not clear how long that will take, but Hawkins says she still loves Wheaton and wants to keep teaching there. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
A Hellfire missile goes to Europe, ends up in Cuba. How that happened, later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Volkswagen is here to say sorry. On Sunday, ahead of the Detroit Auto Show, the company's CEO, Matthias Müller, apologized to American consumers for building cars that cheated on emissions tests. But the German carmaker's on another mission here as well. Tomorrow, Müller is visiting the EPA, and he's expected to propose a fix to bring VW's tainted diesel models into compliance with U.S. pollution standards. Greg Archer is with the nonprofit Transport and Environment. He's based in Europe, where VW has already reached an agreement with authorities to reduce high nitrogen oxide emissions.
The solution in Europe was really very simple. I mean, they developed a plastic tube with a grid in it, which they fitted in front of the air inlets for the cylinders. It was a much simpler solution to the one that they will be able to use in the US, because the emissions limits for diesel NOx emissions in Europe are about four times higher than the US limits are, where the same limits apply to both gasoline and diesel vehicles.
So what kind of technology, and more importantly, what kind of cost will VW have to present to the EPA to solve the problems here?
Well, there's a couple of options. The first is a system called selective catalytic reduction, or SCR. And in that, they inject a chemical into the exhaust pipe called urea, and that traps the nitrogen oxides. But nobody's ever retrofitted this type of system to a diesel car, and it would certainly be expensive and very tricky to do. The second option, which we understand that they're considering, is to fit some kind of catalytic converter to trap the nitrogen oxides, which will probably be easier for them to do, but less effective in terms of reducing the nitrogen oxide emissions. So it remains to be seen whether or not the solution is able to meet those much more stringent US limits.
Yeah, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of automobiles, right, to retrofit.
Yes, hundreds of thousands of vehicles in the US.
What are some of the practical challenges of that?
Well, the practical challenges are simply finding space within the vehicle to fit either a selective catalytic reduction or a catalytic system into the exhaust pipes. There isn't a great deal of space on a lot of vehicles, so physically it's quite difficult to do.
I mean, we saw some apparent global unity in Paris at the climate change summit in December. This may sound like a rhetorical question given what we know about VW, but why don't car manufacturers like VW just make all their cars to meet the highest emission standards so they can distribute the same car all over the world?
Well, the simple reason is cost. The reason that Volkswagen chose to manipulate the emissions tests in the US was because they didn't want to fit a selective catalytic reduction system to these US diesel cars. That probably would have cost them maybe $200 or $300 more, and they simply didn't want to incur those costs.
So finally, Greg, what about the car buyers and VW loyalists who got burned by the VW brand? What's VW going to have to do to make them happy?
Well, VW has already given its US customers $1,000, but I think they're going to have to offer a good package of compensation. And clearly their brand has been damaged by this. And I think the reputation of diesel cars in the US has probably been irreparably damaged by this scandal.
Greg Archer, head of the Clean Vehicles Program at the Brussels-based nonprofit Transport and Environment. Thank you very much for your time, Greg.
Thank you very much.
And today, California rejected a separate plan by VW to meet even stricter air quality regulations there. Regulators said the carmaker's proposed fix wasn't good or fast enough, but that they'd continue talks with VW. If you followed the Women's Soccer World Cup last summer, you most definitely remember Carly Lloyd. The midfielder helped the U.S. Women's National Team win the cup, scoring 3 goals in the final against Japan, including an incredible shot from midfield to complete her hat trick.
Lloyd with Morgan streaking. She's chipping the goalkeeper!
Last night, Lloyd was recognized as the 2015 FIFA Women's World Player of the Year. We called up Caitlin Fisher to get her reaction. She's a former professional soccer player, and she remembers playing with Carly Lloyd when they were both teenagers.
We started playing on the Region 1 team together when we were about 16. And then when we were 19, we both made the under-21 national team together. I mean, I couldn't be more proud right now of her and seeing where she's come.
What was it like to see her land the FIFA Woman Player of the Year award?
Just incredible. Really incredible. I mean, I've just seen her over the years, kind of all the ups and downs that she's gone through and people not believing in her, but her constantly believing in herself and just seeing her get to this place of being the best in the world. So really just so proud of her.
Yeah. Anybody who didn't have Carly Lloyd on their radar screen last summer during that match, U.S. versus Japan for the final, that incredible rematch, probably thought, where has she been? Yeah. Was she always the natural we saw in that final?
She's not the most consistent player, and she hasn't ever been, but she does have this tendency to pull through in really clutch moments in big games. You know, she scored the game-winning goal in the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, in 2012 in London to win the 2 gold medals, and then we saw her last summer at the World Cup. So she has this tendency, but there's many games where she doesn't appear. People don't notice her at all. But I think many of these kind of dips that she's had in her career have propelled her further and gotten her even higher. And you've seen this drive in her that she's constantly asking, how can I improve? How can I improve?
Give me an example of that, because I know you've seen her grow and change as a player.
Well, it was funny. Even I was just recollecting back to when we were 19, we first made the under-21 national team. That summer, it was the Nordic Cup. I got selected as an alternate, so didn't end up going. But she made the roster, and she turned to me and she said, I'm not really sure I want to go. I don't know if I should do that. I don't know if I can do this. And really very little confidence of going into this. She wasn't a starter. She had just made it. And just laughing with her now, it was maybe 10 years ago that she got this personal trainer named James to work with her. And he's been alongside her the entire time and really saw this potential in her. She has constantly said to him, you know, how can I take my game to the next level?
Apparently she thanked him in her speech.
To James, we started this journey 13 years ago. You told me that I could become the best player in the world. It just took me the realization now that I could. Thank you for everything.
I gather he's been pretty tough on her, telling her things like, you know, even if I call you at 10 at night and you're at a party, you're going to come out and kick balls with me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but she would be the first to say I'm there before you even call me. But absolutely, yeah.
Sports Illustrated, as you know, named Serena Williams a Sports Person of the Year, which is a rare honor that magazine gives to a woman. A lot of people said it should have been Carly Lloyd just for that midfield goal alone against Japan. Do you think the FIFA Woman Player of the Year honor kind of goes part of the way to writing what many say was a Sports Illustrated bad?
There's no doubt in so many people's minds that 2015, these past 12 months, that Carly Lloyd was one of the top, if not the top, female athlete on the planet for what she did and her performance. Serena Williams is an entirely different category because her consistency over the years is incomparable. Two very different things. But if we just look at the past 12 months, what Carly did, hands down, I think is the top performance. Really excited to see what she brings to Rio for the Olympics.
Caitlin Fisher, former professional soccer player, now a soccer activist with Discover Football. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Later on the show, Ringling Brothers gets ready to say goodbye to its elephants, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, anger in Haiti over how international aid mismanaged things after the quake 6 years ago.
Much of the building back Haiti was done the same way that people always did business. It wasn't well coordinated among the agencies, but more important, it wasn't well coordinated with the Haitian people.
Where the aid money went, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's 6 years today since an earthquake devastated Haiti. It's not known exactly how many people died, but it was more than 200,000. In the immediate aftermath, the world rallied and pledged enormous amounts of assistance and development aid. But in Haiti today, there is anger about the promises that have fallen short. Brian Concannon is executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. He's based here in Boston. So the UN estimates that $10 billion has been pledged, but only about half of that has been spent. So let's start with where that money has gone in Haiti. What has worked? Where has it gone to?
I think where the money worked was mostly in the emergency response. There was a lot of very good medical treatment. The rubble was cleared. There was some food programs, other things. It just kept people alive, and it probably saved thousands of lives, perhaps tens of thousands, and was very effective. And clearing the rubble allowed the city to move forward. And so that part, I think, was fairly effective.
But what hasn't worked, and why are Haitians so angry?
What hasn't worked is the more sustainable initiatives. The buzzword 6 years ago was build Haiti back better. And that simply didn't happen. Where I think the international community focused on the things that were easy and did their best on the things that were easy. The harder things like building schools, helping the government provide basic government services, improving the employment situation, those kinds of things didn't work. I think a lot of the aid money was poorly spent. A disproportionate amount of it was spent on international experts or headquarters back in Washington and other places. Not as much as should have gotten to the ground, actually got to the ground. But what Haitians will really tell you is the big problem is that they weren't consulted. Much of the building back Haiti was done the same way that people always did business. It wasn't well coordinated among the agencies, but more important, it wasn't well coordinated with the Haitian people. For everybody from top government officials down to poor people in the street complained that they weren't consulted and they felt that these programs were just being imposed on them without their participation. And they obviously had a lot to offer on how to do things well that wasn't taken.
Why did all this happen? Because development organizations, they know how these things are supposed to work. They know their work isn't easy, that the hard stuff comes after the cleanup. And why weren't Haitians consulted? I mean, you've got to have buy-in from the locals.
I was at a conference held by the Clinton Foundation right after the earthquake, a donors conference, where they made exactly those points. They said, we need to do things differently. We need to bring Haitians in. We need to be sustainable. People said the right things over and over again. But unfortunately, most of the organizations went back to doing things the way they always did. And partly is it's just doing what you know how to do, and it's hard to change. And I think that a lot of the just the metrics and the way people evaluate their work keep people to do the old ways of doing it. For example, people count, you know, how many patients they treated rather than how well they developed the system for Haiti to sustainably treat its patients. And the medical example was a great example because there were a lot of lives saved, but you also put Haitian hospitals out of work. Haitian doctors emigrated to the U.S. because they couldn't work because there were so many foreign volunteers coming, which was obviously generous of those volunteers to come down. But the way it was implemented had some negative effects on the overall Haitian system.
You mentioned the Clinton Foundation and that conference right after the earthquake. I mean, they were saying the right things, but now the Clinton Foundation has come under particular scrutiny for their work post-earthquake in Haiti. Why is that?
It's a very interesting example because one of the things that the Clinton Foundation has done from the beginning is to try to advance aid accountability. They've been very strong in encouraging people first to donate, but to try to hold people accountable to their pledges. But there's a perception that the Clinton Foundation has not been as accountable on its own. There's obviously been reports here about failure to disclose different things and problems with their basic accountability. In Haiti, people read those news stories. Their main concern is the large gap between some of the promises that were made and what's been delivered on the ground.
Specifically, what's the one thing they often point to when they cite this?
Well, one of the things people point to is there were a lot of schools that were built with trailers, and they ended up being the same types of trailers that were used in New Orleans after Katrina.
Like the famous FEMA trailer?
Exactly. Yeah. And they had some of the same problems, including chemical contamination. They were also supposed to be shelters against hurricanes, and they weren't strong enough to do that.
And were these trailers brokered by the Clinton Foundation?
They were.
So now, 6 years after the earthquake, what kind of grade would you give to the international community as a whole for their response and their work in developing the country again?
I'm not quite sure what scale that is, but I would say probably
say
a
F
C.
To A.
I'd probably say about a C. I mean, you certainly need to recognize what was done. You also need to recognize the great generosity and outpouring of support by ordinary citizens and governments. But I really think that we missed an opportunity to transform Haiti and to transform the way that disaster responses are done worldwide.
Brian Concannon is the executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Thank you very much for coming in, Brian.
Well, thank you for having me.
There was at least one silver lining to the very dark cloud that was Haiti's 2009 earthquake. It helped improve relations between Haiti and its neighbor, the Dominican Republic. After the quake, the DR reached out to Haiti to offer assistance, and Haiti welcomed the offer. But things have gotten bad between them again. Last year, the Dominican government told Haitian migrants living in the DR without legal papers to leave, and many did because they suddenly feared for their lives. Now thousands of them are living just on the other side of the border in Haiti, but as Amy Bracken reports from the border, many can't resist slipping back into the DR.
Since last summer, a sea of makeshift shelters has emerged along the southern end of the Haiti-Dominican border. Some call them camps, for lack of a better term, but that's generous. They're a collection of shelters made of scavenged sticks, cardboard, tattered clothing, and ripped tarps. Mercis lives here now with his parents and two sons. We're using just his first name to protect his identity. He worked in the Dominican Republic as a farmhand for 8 years. But he says last June, his family gave up everything and walked across the border. They were threatening us in the DR, he says. If they were going to do something bad, we didn't want to wait for it. They said if we didn't go the easy way, they'd make us go the hard way. And there were rumors of Dominicans stockpiling machetes, which seemed credible, Mirsi says, given the history here. They said what happened under Trujillo, if people didn't leave, they could make it happen again, he says. In 1937, under orders from Dominican dictator Rafael Trujillo, thousands of Haitians were massacred along the Dominican side of the border. Now, Mircis and his family live in this border camp amid heat, dust, and a fresh outbreak of cholera. But perhaps hardest to take, there is no income. So how do you survive, I ask him. He says he crosses the border to do jobs at the farm where he used to work. I cross on foot, with one eye in front and one eye in back, he says, to make sure no one hits me from behind. My heart is always jumping. Mercis is not alone. North along the border, down a steep, rocky road, is a valley filled with more permanent dwellings and vegetable gardens. Andrés Jean-Louis greets us as we walk down the road. He says he moved here last March after some Dominicans threatened to burn down Haitian homes in the DR. He points to a white cliff topped with trees. That's the Dominican Republic, he says. And among those trees, you can make out spots where the sun glints off glass or metal. Those are Dominican barracks, there and there, he says. There's one over there where they try to prevent people from crossing if they have no papers. We walk through the settlement and pick up a narrow path. A local named Jean-Joseph Daniel says this is a daily commuter route. This is the path you take to get to the Dominican Republic. It's usually easy to get through, he says. There are mornings they won't let you pass without papers, but people take the risk, and at about 5 a.m, they head to work across the border. I'm told some people walk upwards of 3 hours every day to reach their farm jobs in the DR. Just before the path descends into a dried-up riverbed, it passes a stone border marker. There are no guards here. On the Haitian side, in a hut made of branches, Christella Saint-Ime sits on a foam mattress on the ground, nursing her 6-week-old baby. Yeah, when I came here from the DR, I was 5 months pregnant. They said what happened under Trujillo, if we didn't leave, that could happen again, she says, referring to the massacre in 1937. I ask where the baby's father is. The baby's dad? He came here with us, but there's no work on this side, she says. He's gone back to the Dominican Republic. For the World, Amy Bracken, at the Haitian-Dominican border.
Here's a headline you don't like to hear. A missile belonging to the United States went missing 2 years ago. Here's what else we know. The missile is a Hellfire and had been sent to Europe for training purposes. Then instead of being returned to the U.S., it just vanished. Fast forward 2 years, it is now reported to have been found in Cuba. So what happened? I have Devlin Barrett on the line to tell us more. He and his colleague Gordon Lubald reported this for the Wall Street Journal. This was a Hellfire missile. Like I said, it was sent to Europe for training purposes. A Hellfire missile is not nuclear. What does it do? Just remind us.
A Hellfire missile is essentially an air-to-surface missile. You've probably heard of it most common in anti-terrorist attacks when a drone, a predator drone, strikes at a terrorist target in, say, countries like Yemen or Pakistan. It was originally developed as a helicopter-fired missile to shoot down tanks. But over in the decades since it was first developed, they've created a lot of other uses for it, including terrorist strikes.
So what happened to this Hellfire missile after it was being used for training in Europe?
So it was sent to Spain to be used in a NATO exercise, and it was used in the NATO exercise. What happens after that is pretty bewildering, confounding to investigators. It ends up essentially going on a long, strange journey through Europe, including, you know, a truck to Germany and then a truck to Paris. And then finally someone puts it on a Air France flight that's going to Havana, Cuba. And that's when officials, U.S. officials realize, oh, wait, we've just accidentally sent one of our Hellfires to Cuba, which is a sanctioned country. They're not supposed to be getting any of our military equipment under any circumstances, let alone a Hellfire missile.
I mean, somebody had to be packing it in a box and putting it on those trucks. And who was doing all that?
Well, that's right. And one of the oddities of this entire case is that, you know, this is something sent in commercial shipping. This wasn't a military shipper. But in commercial shipping, equipment like this is clearly labeled as sensitive export controlled technology, meaning there's a big label on the box that says this is to come right back to the United States, export controlled. So anyone who saw this package should have known right out of the gate that this wasn't supposed to go on any, you know, let's say, additional excursions. But unfortunately, it went on multiple additional excursions, ending in Havana. So now there's a criminal investigation to determine if that was the work of criminals or spies or just a series of really strange mistakes.
How was it discovered that it was in Cuba?
Well, when the plane lands in Cuba, not surprisingly, you know, local officials inspect the cargo. And a local official looked at the box and immediately seized it. At which point, our understanding is that, you know, the shippers notified Lockheed Martin, which makes the missile and initially shipped it out, that the box had been taken by Cuban officials. So they knew pretty soon after it was taken that the Cuban government had it, and they've been trying for more than a year and a half to get Cuba to give it back.
Is there anything to suggest that the intent of this trip this missile took was criminal or for destructive purposes?
It's really unclear yet, although what has been said to me by a number of officials is this package, because it moved through shipping companies and what's called freight forwarders, it passed through a lot of hands, more than a dozen hands before it ended up in Cuba. And there's a skepticism among some people in the government that because it passed through so many hands, it will be very hard to make a criminal case out of what happened, because anyone you might charge could easily say, hey, I was just one part of this very long chain, and you can't find me criminally liable for what a dozen other people also did.
What is Cuba saying about this? Don't know how this missile got here. Don't know why anybody would want it.
Nothing. They haven't been returning our calls on this subject, interestingly enough. They have been rebuffing any attempts, we're told, to get it back by the U.S. government, but they haven't been responding to our questions.
Why would a Hellfire missile be useful to Cuba?
Well, it's important to remember there's no explosives in this missile. This is a training missile, but it's valuable in the wider world because most countries, you know, they don't need explosives. Most countries have explosives. What they need and want is the technology that delivers the explosives. So what we're told by military experts is that what's interesting to foreign governments is the sensor technology, the targeting technology that's in Hellfire missiles. And that's of value, but not necessarily to Cuba. I spoke to a number of folks, both inside and outside the U.S. government, who said, you know, they really don't have any concerns that Cuba will develop its own Hellfire program. They're not viewed as militarily that ambitious. But what they are very concerned about is that Cuba would share or trade in some fashion the Hellfire missile with countries like China or North Korea or Russia.
Devlin Barrett with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much, Devlin.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If I say Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, you may very likely say elephants. If you do, prepare to rid yourself of that association. As of May 1st, the circus will be ending its elephant performances. Elizabeth Hogan is with World Animal Protection.
Well, it's obviously fantastic news for the elephants. The welfare of the animals is severely compromised anytime that they're held in captivity, and in particular, the forced performances and long-distance transport is horrendous for these animals. So the sooner they are no longer in those conditions, the better.
There were some complaints, too, about how the elephants were treated behind the scenes. What were the nature of those complaints?
any elephant that is in captivity has gone through a process that's known in the industry as the crush. That literally is a reference to the act of breaking the animal's spirit so that they will be willing to respond to human commands and perform. That means that as a juvenile, the elephant was taken from its mother, tied down, immobilized, and beaten until it is willing to respond to human commands, which are almost entirely based on violence and sometimes the withholding of food. So it is a horrible process for the animals to go through.
Wow. Ringling Brothers says, though, it was an economic calculation. I know they've also been under pressure from animal rights groups to stop elephant shows because of what you're talking about. What really led to this decision, do you think?
I was not part of how they reached this particular decision. I am very aware of organizations, including my own, that try to raise awareness of the sentience of these animals, the suffering that they go through, and the fact that our entertainment is no reason for them to be subject to these conditions.
Just last month, I was in Nairobi, Kenya, and visiting the elephant orphanage. And since you advocate on behalf of animals worldwide, I'm wondering if you can tell us how far and wide will this decision be felt, do you think?
I think it will actually be felt very far. Ringling Brothers is such a household name, very much associated with performing elephants. They've always highlighted the elephants on their posters and in their advertising. And so while it is indeed a small number of actual elephants being released from performances, the actions of Ringling Brothers are something that are going to be recognized worldwide. And for them to finally change their tune, that sends a huge message to the entertainment industry itself and to tourists who might otherwise think of buying a ticket.
I mean, elephants have been kind of an icon of the Ringling Brothers circus ever since P.T. Barnum brought Jumbo to America in 1882. Is this the end of an era?
I certainly hope that this is one step towards ending the role of elephants in human entertainment and that it can lead to other animals being released from a life in captivity as well.
Elizabeth Hogan directs campaigns for world animal protection. Very appreciative of your time today, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Finally, President Obama delivers his final State of the Union address tonight. And when he speaks, a young Syrian-American social media activist will be in the audience.
My name is Ella Basatne. I'm 19 years old. I live right outside of Chicago with my parents and my younger brother, Louis. I used to pretty much go to the mall with friends, you know, just have fun. But nowadays, I don't have time. I'm responsible for hundreds of people on the ground in Syria.
That's Ella Basatne, who was profiled in the documentary Chicago Girl, The Social Network Takes on a Dictator. She's 23 now and still works online with the Syrian opposition. She visited Syria twice in recent years, but after extremists threatened her life, she canceled plans for a third trip. Her work caught the eye, though, of Illinois Democrat Representative Mike Quigley, and he asked her to be his guest tonight at the president's address. Basatne says the invite boosted her spirits at a time when it is tough to be a Muslim in America.
Just walking on the streets, I would get comments that are very non-American, the least to say, something along the lines of, go back to your country, or I would get dirty looks just because I'm wearing the headscarf. It's been really hard, but I know that if I was to sit and reason with every single person that's giving me the hard time, that they will come back to their senses and understand that I am a human just like them.
Congressman, you must have seen the story a week or so ago when a Muslim woman, a 56-year-old flight attendant, was escorted out of a Donald Trump campaign after she stood up in silent protest. Apparently some people were standing near her, grabbed her hand and said sorry, but others were shouting things like, she has a bomb. What went through your head when you watched that and thought about tonight's speech?
It's difficult to watch. All I can do is do things like we're doing tonight, invite her to the State of the Union. I hope when people talk to my guest tonight, they see a smart, brave young woman putting her life at risk. I hope people see that and begin to slow down the hatred, recognize that this country does better when we don't pit one group against each other. We don't try to find scapegoats.
So, Ala, what was your reaction?
Well, I was really happy to see that standing next to Rose.
Rose Hamid, she was the one standing in the Trump crowd, right?
Yes. Yeah. Was a Jewish American who had the same sticker on his chest that Rose was wearing that said Muslim on it, even though he's Jewish. It shows the unity. It shows how much Americans from all different backgrounds are standing next to each other, hand in hand, saying no to Islamophobia, saying no to hatred.
And yet those opinions are very easy to find these days. Does it feel to you like bigotry has become kind of normalized in America today?
No, and it will never be the land of bigotry.
Representative Quigley, just a few days ago, the governor of your neighboring state, Scott Walker of Wisconsin, tweeted something provocative. He said the arrest of two Iraqi refugees in California and Texas with ties to ISIS vindicated his stance against allowing Syrian refugees into the U.S. And one of these men was, in fact, online commenting about wanting to return to Syria to fight for ISIS. Did those arrests give you pause?
No, I think it's easy to differentiate that which the real risks are. I serve on the House Select Committee on Intelligence. We have to understand that Oklahoma City was an American-born terrorist. That screening process for refugees is more thorough than any other process that anyone coming to the United States is involved. There are risks involved with freedom, and I appreciate and understand that. We need to be safe. We need to protect ourselves. But that doesn't allow bigotry and hatred to rule the day.
And given that this is President Obama's last State of the Union address, Alaa, what do you hope will be Obama's legacy?
President Obama has done a great job advocating for the Syrian people, but we do truly need international action. We need the international community to collaborate for the sake of the Syrian people.
Do you think he should have made more bold moves early on, like the red lines when there was evidence of chemical weapons attacks?
Yes, I do. I think President Obama should have intervened when those red lines were crossed by Assad and his regime.
Alaa Basatneh is a Syrian-American social media activist profiled in the documentary Chicago Girl, The Social Network Takes on a Dictator. She'll be an official guest at tonight's State of the Union address and was invited by Illinois Democrat Representative Mike Quigley. Congressman and Alaa, thank you both very much today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll hear what the president will have to say tonight soon enough from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.